IFPRI Policy Seminar, the 2014 Global Nutrition Report Launch, held on December 9, 2014 in Washington, D.C. Question and answer segment.
I know the states inside India, within India, that we were talking about this at a conference we were at together in New Delhi, Maharashtra, and then you were at the launch of the program in Uttar Pradesh, which is even bigger than Maharashtra, and the problem's more challenging. And they come out with their nutrition report and pretty much predicated on it. If they could do it there, what are we doing?
Same size as Brazil, Uttar Pradesh. And they're going to do a nutrition mission just like Maharashtra. So they're really inspired by that story.
Yeah. So that'll be great. I mean, if the evidence is there and it's shared as farmers and agriculture folks share it and the countries themselves. Open to questions. A hand rises immediately. So we've got about 15, 20 minutes or so. So identify yourselves, and anybody on the panel can answer things.
Yeah, I'm Simon Maxwell. I was lucky enough to chair the launch of this in Parliament in London last week with the minister.
Oh, wow.
Room packed, tremendous enthusiasm. There were two big stories. One is the story about it works, we can do it, let's keep going. But the other story, I think, which is equally interesting, is why is it now so high on the agenda? And I came to this relatively late. You know, Alan Berg was there in the 1970s, but I was on the UN subcommittee on nutrition, and I've just been looking up some of the records here. There was a report in 2000, the James Commission, do you remember? The headline, we can do this, here are the actions, they're cost effective, but actually nothing happened. And the thing that happened that changed that, I think, was actually the work that Lawrence did with ministers and others in the UK, and there was a sudden moment when it unblocked. Where people started committing money and political capital to this issue. And the question I'd like to ask Lawrence, really, is tell us in a bit more detail the story of how that happened when you were director of IDS and the work you did, and how do you stop it now moving backwards?
Well, Simon's being way too generous, thank you, anyway, for doing that. But I think the Lancet 2008 was a big staging point. Then the Sun movement was really important. But I think the big thing that got... I remember it was in number 10 with Gordon Brown, and he had a big meeting of experts. And the big thing was the food price crisis, the food price spike. It just made everyone say, wow, you know, we didn't know this sort of stuff could happen again. And we were very... I mean, the year before, FAO were telling farmers how to cope with low prices in 2006, 2007. And then all of a sudden, there's this massive price spike. I think the thing that the nutrition community in the UK was very good at doing, and maybe in the US as well, I don't know, was to say, okay, there's going to be there's a shock, but this shock is going to be encased in concrete in these kids' bodies for the next 20 or 30 years. So you've got to make sure, you know, households can go above and below the poverty line, and there's a cost, but it's not always a permanent cost. But with kids going above and below some kind of threshold, there's a permanent cost. So we were very good at leveraging that. So I don't think you can give us too much credit. It was the food price crisis was a big part of it. But the nutrition research community really got its act together around that time, and I think it was just a happy coincidence, as is most policy making. Solution streams, problem streams, and political opportunity streams come together.
And how do we prevent backsliding?
Just got to work really hard to work the evidence. That's all I can say. I think we've just got to mobilize social media really well, mobilize traditional media really well, keep doing really good research, keep communicating the research really well, and keep talking to the key decision makers and keep reminding them about the solutions, the possibilities, the returns to the investments, and being really good at not staying in our little nutrition bubble, reaching out beyond the bubble and talking, bringing development into nutrition, and keep doing that, keep scaling from the big picture down to the micro and then back up. And I think coming at it from an Institute of Development Studies, a development perspective, was a big advantage, actually, because we got the development people to pay attention to nutrition in ways they could understand. So the nutrition community has to really be a very broad church. And this is what Alan was saying 30, 40 years ago, and it's still true.
Any other thoughts? Anybody else?
Nutrition suffers from a lack of champions in developing countries, particularly, but also in developed countries. There's no minister of nutrition. in most places, which is a huge problem. And so we need to find operational ways to have champions in countries to translate this goodwill and this funding that is increasingly out there, if it can be harnessed, into real operational outcomes, really reaching the poor, and then get political credit and mileage for it so you can do more. That's how it works. If we can achieve that, we can take this to scale. I'm actually not so concerned about backsliding because I see ourselves at the World Bank, I see IFAD, I see other major donors and funding organizations taking nutritional outcomes increasingly as a mainstream objective in itself, not as a separate selective thing by the nutrition community, but in agriculture, as I said, we are doing it right now. We have already moved our portfolio to 20% from 12% last year. Within 3 years, you will see a big change in the way the money is being applied on the ground for real outcomes with indicators and the whole nine yards. That didn't happen before. Once that's part of the system, it's not going to go away very easily because the moral outrage around this theme is not going to go away. And if we have practical solutions that we can offer, that will then turn into better outcomes. That's how I see it.
It was good to see the Pope actually even talking about the moral outrage in Rome. And I think that's a great, it's this necessary 1-2 punch of the outrage and then you know, kind of the data 3 punch and then the inspiration that something can actually move forward on this. Other questions? Yep.
Yeah, I don't know whether board members should monopolize the questions, but I'm Mahendra Dev from India. I'm in the IFPRI board. You know, it's a great report, and if you see the India story, I think, you know, apart from stunting, the underweight children also, recent global hunger in, report has mentioned 43% to 30% it declined. So it is not only the programs, but also the economic growth, agriculture growth, all helped. So I mean, programs one should have, but agriculture growth, I think you didn't mention agriculture nutrition linkages in your presentation, because a lot of research now in IFPRI as well as outside. The second point is that, you know, influencing the countries, the finance ministers. I think this $16 thing is very important. Because recently I was talking to the India's finance minister, so he's not interested in nutrition. I mean, it's not a big thing for them. But when I said, you know, it's a loss to the country, 2-3% of GDP, if because of undernutrition, and then $1 investment leads to $16. So he was more, you know, curious to know more about these things. So that kind of economic argument is important to influence the, particularly finance ministers. Last one is, I'm a bit confused about the indicator of nutrition. I mean, some people say stunting is very good. Some people say underweight. So which is the right one for, you know, the indicator of nutrition? The undernutrition is high even among the richer classes. Also, of course, obesity and all. So it is not the income factor, but the nutrition education is seems to be more important, particularly for the middle class and the richer classes. Thank you.
Lawrence, stunting, low birth weight.
I'm really tempted to ask Marie Ruel to answer that question, but I'll So you didn't like her answer, so you've come to me for a different answer.
Not a good. Now what's happening? I mean, Marie's in the back.
I thought someone was giving you a microphone there, Marie, but they're not.
Or you can shout.
That would be bad for my neighbors. Stunting is a good indicator, and so is wasting, and so is diet. And so we unfortunately don't have just one indicator. We have multiple indicators, and nutrition is not just children's anthropometry. It really is their diets, their well-being, their health. So we try to simplify things by saying that stunting captures a lot of the dimensions of malnutrition. But we also have, of course, overweight, obesity, that are other indicators of a different type of problem. So I don't think anybody should say this is actually the one that's a bad indicator is underweight, because it combines the information about whether a child is stunted or wasted and or wasted. We can't disentangle. But wasting is a very important indicator, although we've ignored it a bit. It's a very good indicator or important indicator because children are much, much more likely to die if they're wasted and severely wasted than if they're chronically malnourished as in stunting. So we can discuss that later.
Roger, can I just jump in?
Lawrence.
I mean, have you... Thank you, Maria. I completely agree with that. Have you been to the World Bank development indicators lately? It's like asking an economist what's the indicator that we should use for economics.
Okay,
it's just... It just depends on what your interest, which dimension that you're interested in, really. It is difficult to explain the underweight one. When we were in India in October, when Purnima and I and others were teaching that course for Indian officials, they kept saying, why is underweight a bad indicator? And it was really hard to communicate that.
Because a child that is underweight, that means that weighs little, can either be very skinny or very short or both. So it doesn't tell you whether that child suffers from wasting that is low weight for height and is skinny, or whether he's just short. Being short and adequate weight for shortness is not a risk factor for mortality, whereas being skinny is always a risk factor for mortality. Well, it depends how far you take the skinny part. I'm trying to simplify. I just had a point, actually, about, and I also don't want to monopolize, but about the distinction between nutrition sensitive and nutrition specific, that coming back to your point, Richard, I think it's been very useful in nutrition to differentiate the specific and sensitive. But actually, the nutrition-specific interventions are just the interventions that are carried by the health sector. As was mentioned, there is no nutrition anything. There is no nutrition minister or ministry. So the nutrition-specific interventions are usually the ones that the health sector has been doing for us. But if we start counting the investments in specific versus sensitive and all of that, I think it's going to be a big blur, and I hope it becomes a big blur, because we want all the sectors that are relevant to mainstream the nutrition-specific interventions. We want to use them as a platform, for example, agriculture, to deliver some nutrition-specific interventions. So you can't separate anymore. You have a behavior change intervention that is done in the context of an agricultural program. That's a nutrition-sensitive program. Agriculture by itself is not nutrition sensitive. It doesn't necessarily improve nutrition. So I think we shouldn't worry about allocating budgets to sensitive versus specific. We should keep the point of where is nutrition? Is it in education? Is it in social protection? Is it in agriculture? And if so, it's nutrition sensitive and we're happy. And if it's in health, it's nutrition specific, but we're also happy as long as nutrition is there.
I was going to say, I think another important part of the question or a point that you raised are the cost-benefit analysis and the economic numbers, because as Jürgen's talking about nutrition champions in these countries, I think really important that a champion also resides in the finance ministries in addition to agriculture and nutrition, because if they hold the... the purse strings. But Marie also kind of, and I just returned a couple of days ago from Guatemala, and you have this CESAN, which is set up. It's kind of their nutrition instrument inside the government. But a lot of the resources and the action then comes from the health ministry. So they're kind of dependent on that. And where I was in the Western Highlands, whatever front they may be progress they're making on the nutrition front and agriculture front, now there's a sudden shortage of vaccinations. And so the pregnant moms are going for their vaccinations, not there. They're going for when their child is 6 months old or 1 year old, not there. And so that then on this whole multi-sectoral approach really sets things back. We have a internet question.
This question comes from the Bread Institute on Twitter. It says, we all know we need better nutrition data. What next steps do you recommend for boosting investments in better data?
Lawrence, anybody?
Yeah.
I think, can I?
Yep.
I think it's a really good question. I think one of the things we recommend in the report is that either the UN or Sun convene some very focused roundtables in some key countries to establish exactly what the big data gaps are. Thing is, it's really difficult to say what a data gap is. A gap is not where there is no data. A gap is, one of my favorite book reviews is by a guy who started the book review by saying, this book fills a much needed gap. And you think about that. This book fills a much needed gap. In other words, not all books need to be written and not all data gaps need to be filled. So you have to think of the, you ask yourself, is the lack of data holding back action that will reduce malnutrition? That's the question to ask. And it's very hard to do that because there are lots of ifs and counterfactuals in there. But nevertheless, you have to ask that question at a country level. So for, I think, 3 or 4 countries, we will be hoping to set up roundtables with the UN, with Sun, because I think Sun has this convening power to do this. And then to identify, to review the country profiles. We have 193 country profiles where we try to get all 82 indicators for each country, loads of gaps in the profiles. So the gaps are, the profiles say where the gaps are, then the discussion is around which gaps are a priority to fill. And then there's a question of how to do that. And then you can begin to say, well, this is how much it will cost. These are the benefits we expect to generate. So it's to basically inject some rational, systematic thinking into that. And researchers are a big part of that, but not the only part, because researchers always like more data, and we have to be really discerning, it seems to me. Giving rather a waffly answer, because I think there is no perfect answer. But we have to get around the idea that a DHS survey is expensive. It's not. It's less than $1 million. Think about how many times those surveys have been used by people in this room to generate estimates that even if only one of those estimates is picked up to change policy, it's going to generate benefits that are much bigger than $1 million. So we've got to start getting some benefit-cost ratios for investing in nutrition data as well as nutrition.
I think the panelists all have something to say as well. We'll start with Braven and Richard and Jürgen.
Yeah, well, thank you. That is very important. And I just continuation from Lawrence. It's very important at country level. The countries have National Statistics Commission where data is collected. And most of the time it's demand driven. And so all what countries need are specific strengthening capacities in those countries to be able to add on top of what they're collecting is the nutrition data. And so the platforms are there already in the countries. All what is needed is ministries, sectoral ministries, with a Minister of Health of Agriculture or Minister of Water and Sanitation informing National Commission Statistics in the Minister of Finance that we need more data and it will be done. But of course, the issue of technical capacity, and I'm sitting next to the World Bank. I think he's hearing me about this. Capacity.
Richard, and then the World Bank, right? That's
yeah, I would say the biggest gap, what I'd like to see is data that's usable at the subnational level so that every district manager knows, they already know what their immunization rate is, the rate of antenatal care use. What they need to know is what is their burden of stunting, even though it's not a perfect indicator, or wasting in that district. And right now, it's invisible. Just like you walk into a health center, any health center in Africa, South Asia, they know what their vaccination coverage is. They know what their catchment area is, they know what their antenatal care coverage is. They have no idea what their stunting or wasting rates are as a whole for their area. So these are the gaps that I think are most important.
Jürgen.
I think we should never hide between a lack of data. That's actually my view. People never have enough data for all the things we want to do. We need to get on with what we know already today, and that's a lot of it already when I look at the report. We have good case studies. We know interventions that work regardless of what data set you have or what you don't have. And then there are a number of things we have to be cautious because we don't have the evidence and over time develop it. But it should never be, the data first and then we act. There is plenty we can do without having the more accurate data, I believe. And the same is true with capacity. These are two conversations that I feel very uneasy about in many conversations. right? Capacity is actually going down in many countries in the developing world. I don't know how many of you know that the statistical data quality that we have today is a lot worse than what we had 20 years ago. It's not better. We had this conversation at the World Bank just a few months ago around what it is we should be doing. This is the same question. The data question is not unique to nutrition. We need data for everything that we do in interventions. So the World Bank collects a huge number of data, household surveys, what have you. Not inexpensive. It's quite an enterprise. And FAO collects a huge amount of data. And our conclusion has been that we had good data from about 70 to 80% of the countries globally about 20 years ago. Now it's less than 60%. So be under no illusion that overall the data collection, and I'm not talking about nutrition, overall the data collection worldwide is deteriorating because governments are not putting the right the money behind it. So I don't think one can have a very easy conversation around collecting nutrition data without having a conversation around collecting all data, statistical offices, ministries, capacity, what have you. You then have to compete with everybody else for collecting data. Everybody wants their five additional questions in the household survey and in the questionnaire, right? That's just standard procedure. So this is going to be chewy. This is going to be tricky. And yes, we need to pursue it, but I would not make that something that would hold us up for moving forward. The same with capacity. You know, we have success stories in countries and regions and districts of this world that have next to no capacity because of some ingenious individual or some ingenious program, some NGO, some local initiative that launched. It spread like wildfire and it changed the game. And I've seen them with my own eyes. If you compare capacity at the government level, you would say it's non-existent. But things do happen. And so my point is, both on the data and on the capacity, let's find things that work on the ground with simple, with low capacity and very little data and put that to scale. Wherever we can do that, miracles happen. I've seen it repeatedly. It's not arguing against more data. Please don't get me wrong. We do need more data. But the point I was trying to make is let's put that into perspective because it ain't going to happen overnight. And it won't be cheap. And it will take a significant amount of time to get us where we would like to be.
Thank you from everybody. And and finding those examples on the ground that are working are, I think, one should as assiduously look for them as one searches the various data points as well, because there's so many things that are going on the ground that are below the radar. We'll take one more quick question and then... Go ahead there. Yes.
My name is Antonio Galloso. I am with World Hunger Education Service, and I am retired from USAID, although I'm back as a consultant. As I heard all of you talking, I kept thinking, this is a bit bureaucratic. What are the institutions that can do or don't do? But nutrition, in reality, is a two-faceted issue. One is supply, and the other one is demand. And we had years ago a program called NutritionCom, and the idea was to look at the level of ignorance on the part of parents on what was good for their children and themselves. You don't have to go to Congo to find that out. You find it in the United States, in which people are eating all kinds of things that are bad for themselves. So in that sense, if you really want to approach the issue of malnutrition, regardless of what the impacts are, you need not only to look at agricultural supply, food supply, but also as what are the elements of demand. And education is a major, major factor. And we did this project, it was called NutritionCom, with the health, the education sector, and the health sector. And it was incredible. For example, in Congo, they eat a lot of bitter cassava, high in proteins, high in calories, no proteins. One day I was in the zoo in the restaurant and somebody asked me, would you like suteko teko? I said, what is suteko teko? It's the leaf of the cassava that has 8% protein. So there was an element at that level of ignorance where people knew intuitively or because of their parents or whatnot. But if you don't look at the nutrition side from a demand side, then I don't care how much supply we have, it won't work.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really good point. How does one penetrate the households with all this information and get it? Any thoughts, Lauren, Jürgen?
Yeah, we just have a very interesting example. We are supporting the government of Uganda with a program to get nutrition sort of scaled up nationally. And for the first time, I think, in the institution, in the World Bank, we actually interacting with the education minister, the health minister, and the agriculture minister, because there was no nutrition minister, right? But the three are key. So we have worked with them to support a program around school feeding, which is the education side, and the parents get educated during that school feeding program. The health community comes in and makes sure that, you know, the evidence and the data are right. And then the agriculture extension officers in that community are part of the program, and they then produce the food that is deemed necessary locally for local markets at an affordable rate. So the project's trying to square that circle, to put the three together for the first time. For us, it's a first, and it's a very exciting program. It's at its early stages, so I can't report out on success and progress and how the whole jealousies between the ministries will work out, but it's promising, and it's an approach that we need to pursue. So.
Great. Anyone else? Just
very quickly, behavior change is really difficult, whoever you are. I'm kind of intrigued by how whether mobile technology is going to make it better or easier or worse or more difficult. So when I was at the Sun Global Gathering about a month ago, and the countries are definitely doing a lot. They're experimenting a lot with mobile technology for nutrition behavior change. And I think we as researchers need to catch up with that.
Rave, did you have something?
Yeah, I just had a small, you know, remark. Yeah, thank you very much. Education is very important, but it's also the gender dynamics in the household that are very key. We've emphasized the importance of educating the woman, you know, the mother care, but it's in Africa, it's extremely important not to forget the man as well, because there are social and cultural dynamics in there. But in Malawi, a particular case that really helped at a community level, in addition to gender, is actually making the village headmans champions in the villages, because they are custodian of culture and they have huge influence on the community. The moment they make a law according to the dimensions in the village, they can even punish a household by paying a goat for not doing one, two, three things. So, and it has shown for maternal health in Malawi that it has had such great impact of such small models and success stories. So the gender dimension and community involvement.
Thank you. I think this was a really great discussion. A lot of ground covered, a lot of wow factors, outrage and inspiration. So that's great. And so to put a cherry on top of the whole discussion, we'll go to IFPRI Director General Schengen Fond for closing comments. And then we'll have a great round of applause for everybody.
All right, good.
At the end. How's that? Well, or now. Thank you.